All right, do we have to do it again for the tape? Okay, so Neil Criss is at SAC Capital. That's a hedge fund in New York, and this problem is really motivated by very real problems that he faced in his work. So I don't have to make this point too strongly here. I don't think there'll be too much objection that there are good math problems in finance, but let me just emphasize why I think that's true. Sort of three reasons compared to other parts of math. One is that these problems are really important, so there's a lot of money that changes hands based on the solutions of the math problems, and they come from real challenges in the real world. They're not made up. Second point that I really want to keep in mind is that the problems are very messy problems, and a consequence of that is that the math you do needs to be simple, I claim. So the more complicated the original problem, the simpler the math. It doesn't mean it should not be good math. It's all the more important that the math be good, simple but good. And then finally, the other point, which I feel sort of strongly about, I've exploited it with a couple of papers that I've written, is that there's a lot more to math finance than option pricing and stochastic calculus. And in particular, this, I think, is an excellent example of other kind of math that you might not have suspected. So what I'm going to tell you about, this is the outline of the talk, is the example I'm going to give you about mathematical finance. I want to emphasize that it's motivated by very realistic problems. What I want to do is briefly review classic portfolio optimization, talk about why that doesn't work, or what the problems are that you encounter when you try to do that in real life situations. And then the heart of our work is this definition of a new notion of optimality, which has two pieces. First is a partial ordering, then a full ordering. Then I'm going to show you how this applies to more general information types of things, and then some simple empirical tests to convince you that this sort of crazy proposal makes sense. So let me review. I know it's fairly well known, but let me go through it to make the points that I want to make. Markowitz, 1952, showed a good way to solve the following problem. You're a portfolio manager. You have N assets that you can invest in, maybe a large number, U.S. stocks or Canadian stocks. There's thousands of them. And your goal is to take the wealth that has been entrusted to you and to allocate it among those assets to do two things. You want to maximize the return on your investment, and you want to minimize the risk in some way. I mean, however they're defined, that's your goal. You want to achieve that and minimize that. And your tools, the inputs to whatever math model you make, is that you have some model for the asset price motion and you know what the parameters are, or you have some estimate, and then you put those into some kind of optimization thing and you out comes your portfolio. So the mathematical framework which we use, this is sort of the most symbols on a slide of any slide that I have, but it's really simple. It's basically just regular old Brownian motion. So they're one period returns. The assumption here is that using the notation capital R for the realized return, that's a Gaussian random variable. Well, it's a vector. So capital R is a vector, is a Gaussian random variable, which is completely characterized by its expectation, its expected value, which is the little r, the vector little r, and then the covariance matrix, Vij. And so the vector R is the expected returns, V is the covariance matrix. And because these are assumed to be Gaussian, that's all the information you need. No fat tails, no Levy processes, no nothing. But one of the points I want to make is that mathematically, R and V are simply the first and second moments of a distribution. They're sort of the same thing. But in practice, they come from very different sources. The R, the expected return, that's the one where the portfolio manager considers that he adds value. So that's the hard part. I mean, there are good mathematical reasons that it's very hard to predict that from past data. So that's the one where you go out and visit the factory and you know, analyze all your 17 different factors and so on and so forth of what's going to happen to the economy. And that's really the thing you have, you know, your finance input goes into that. The second moment, the covariance matrix, usually you get them from historical data. And that would be, and there's an assumption there, of course, that the parameters are reasonably stable, but it's hard to forecast, so you just usually assume that they're stable. And you might even buy it from a provider like Barra. So you don't really consider maybe wrongly, maybe rightly, but people don't usually consider that they add a lot of value by improving their estimates of covariance. They usually put their effort on estimating the returns. And then mathematically, the problem is you make a vector W1 to WN, which is the dollars you invest in the ith asset, and we'll assume that you can go short, so W can be negative. You can borrow if you want. And then in terms of this portfolio vector, the return, total return on the portfolio is the inner product, W transpose times R. You want to maximize that. And then the return, or the variance, which is the uncertainty, well, it's how we measure the risk, is simply the quadratic product of the portfolio vector with the covariance matrix. And you want to minimize that. So what you're trying to do is maximize the one, minimize the other. Now, there's sort of some standard mathematical ways to do this. The classic one is actually somewhat more modern. If you go back, Markowitz didn't do it this way, although everybody thinks he did, is you put in a utility function. The simplest kind of utility function is just a quadratic utility, which is parameterized by a number lambda, which is the curvature of the utility, or it's a risk aversion parameter. And then you say, I want to maximize expected return, and then I'll penalize variance. And then I maximize the scalar quantity over all vectors. And there could, of course, be constraints here, but let's ignore that for now. The other way to do the same thing, which is actually the one that we're going to take going forward, is you impose, and it's actually somewhat more characteristic of how people do it in real life, because you ask people what their risk aversion parameter is in inverse dollars, they don't know. But a more typical way to do it is you set a risk budget, and so you do a constrained optimization. Within a certain level of allowable risk, you try to achieve the highest return. And of course, mathematically, these are equivalent. The way you solve the constrained problem is to introduce a Lagrange multiplier, and that gives you the first problem. And in both cases, the solution is essentially the same. So the portfolio vector is the inverse of the covariance matrix times the expected return with some suitable normalization that depends either on your risk level or your risk aversion parameter. And what that basically says, I mean, it's very easy to see what the intuition is. For example, suppose V were diagonal, so that you just had a variance for each asset. It would just say essentially W is proportional to R divided by the volatility of that asset. So basically, you put more weight into the assets that have higher expected return with some normalization for volatility. And then, of course, if there are correlations and covariances, it's a little bit more complicated. But that's the intuition. And then if R were negative, you had an asset with a negative expected return, this would say you go short, I mean, unless the covariances change it. So that's the classic mean variance optimization. Why does this not work? Why does this not work? What are the problems in practice? There are two problems. Well, there's a bunch of problems, but let me focus on two. The first problem is that the inputs are these expected returns R. The output is the portfolio weights, which are actual dollars that you're going to invest. R is only very approximately known, and I'll show you the next slide as a picture that this is very sensitive optimization. So small changes in R give big changes in W. So people talk about doing stuff like robust optimization techniques, where you basically try to maximize the expected return over all. So you assume that the expected return is within, say, an ellipse whose center is the value you think it is, but you put some errors on it, and then you sort of maximize the minimum over that ellipse. The other problem, which is a more fundamental problem, is you may simply not have these numbers R sub I. This is what we're really talking about. You simply may not have these numbers. What you may have is only a list of assets. I'll give you some reasons why this might be on the next page. So what somebody might give you is just a list. Say, I put these assets into order. I think stock 1 is better than stock 2, is better than stock 3, and then stock N is the worst of all, but there's no numbers. There's no numbers associated with it. That's what we're talking about. Here's an example of the sensitivity. So this is a slide from a presentation by Sebastian Seria at the Chicago Quantitative Alliance a couple years ago. The left picture here is, for all of these stocks, these are the expected returns. There are little error bars, which are very small. So if you basically vary the expected return within those bands, the right picture is the variation in portfolio weights that go along with it. And the point is that these bars on the right are much bigger than these bars on the left. So tiny changes in the expected return input give rise to large changes in the actual portfolio investment. Actual dollars changing hand. And then the second point is, why might it be that you might lack these quantitative values? A couple of reasons. One is that your estimates, you may have estimates which come from some indicator, some qualitative value, which you believe is somehow correlated with returns, positive returns. So if this indicator is large, the return will be large. If this indicator is small, return might be negative. Some examples, there's this reversal hypothesis, which is stocks that went up in the previous week are likely to go down this week. Momentum is sort of the obvious, the opposite of that. Stocks that went up over the previous time period may continue to go up. Or book to market. So what you do is you make a table of all the book to market ratios and maybe separately sized for all the stocks in your portfolio, and you think that stocks that have high book to market are likely to go up. How much? It's hard to know. I mean, if book to market is 5.3, does that translate into 3% expected return or not? You don't really know. You don't know the precise relationship to R. Another reason where this might come up is you might buy a list. People do this. So they go around. They say, if you pay me $1,000 a month, then every week I will email you a list of stocks, you know, in order, ranking of the S&P 500 stocks. And I do it from my secret algorithm that I'm not going to tell you. And I'm not going to give you the numbers that are associated with it. I'm just going to give you the list. What you do with it is your business. And that exists. People do that. And then the final thing is you might have some algorithm that gives you some numbers, but you might not believe it. So you might have these indicators, but you may say, all I want to take from that is just the crude ordering. I really want to throw out the numbers. You know, if one of them is 3.9 versus 3.95, I don't believe it. So in that sense, this is sort of an alternative to robust regression. The algorithm would be, take your indicator, throw away the numbers, just keep the ordering. So that's to convince you that this is an interesting problem. All right, so what do you do? Obviously, the world has not been sitting still, waiting for us to do the mathematics. What people commonly do, the obvious things to do, are one strategy would simply be buy the top, sell the bottom. So you could, for example, if you take your stock you think is the best, the one that you think is the worst, take a long position in the best asset, take a short position in the last asset. And that should be the best portfolio you can make. In practice, you probably wouldn't put all your money into the two assets on the ends. You would diversify a little bit by, say, taking the top 10%, the bottom 10%. That's a crude way to diversify. Obviously, not a very systematic way to do it. Or slightly more sophisticated, you might put your money sort of with a linear weighting. So you might take a long position in the first asset, short position in the last asset, and sort of linearly weight, so the ones in the middle get less. The disadvantage of doing that, both of those things, is that you ignore the covariance information. There's no risk assessment there. There's no, not only volatilities, but no correlations either. And one of the things Markowitz pointed out, by the way, in his original paper, is that it's not enough to just risk adjust the individual returns. You have to take account of the correlations. So, say that again, this does not use covariance information, and that's bad, because covariance is an essential part of the problem. The second thing you can do, and this is what some of the more sophisticated people do, is that you could in some way invent returns from the ordering. So you could use something like, these are called normal scores, is a typical way to do it. So you say, I'll list the things, and then I'll just assign returns, which are, say, values of the inverse cumulative normal distribution. And I'll make up that return vector, which respects the ordering, but fills in a lot more information besides, and then use mean variance optimization. So you do bring in the covariance matrix. But what you have had to do in order to do that is make a completely ad hoc choice of these expected returns. And that, I'm not saying that's a bad thing to do, but I'm saying, what is the conceptual foundation and how could you extend that to more complicated cases? And so I claim, actually, our proposal is very similar to that, but we have a systematic reasoning behind it. All right, so let me start talking about the math. So, let me generalize this a little bit. So I have a bunch more examples at the end, but let me say in general what we're doing. If you have a sort, so what I'm saying is that the expected returns, I believe, are in order. So R1 is bigger than R2, is bigger than R3, all the way down to Rn. What that really is a list of statements. It's actually n minus one statements, which are inequality relationships among the components of the expected return vector. And let me say, by the way, the fundamental assumption is that there exists a distribution, so there exists this Gaussian distribution that has an expected return, that has a covariance matrix. We know the covariance matrix, and we believe it. The problem is that we don't know the value of the expected return vector. Instead, we have some inequality information about it. Could be a sort, or it could be more general. So the general type of information that we have could be some other list of inequalities. I'll give you a bunch of examples, but could be fewer than this, could be more than this, but it's some homogeneous inequalities among the components of the expected return vector. And there's another assumption here, which is that this list of inequalities contains all the information that we have about the expected return. So you might say, I believe this is true, but I also kind of think that the more volatile stocks are going to go up more. I say, if you believe that, put it in here. If you don't put it in here, I'm not going to use any other information about the first moments. That's all that we have. And also, we're not allowed to make statements like, I think that R1 will do 3% better than R2. All we can do, these have to be homogeneous, so there's no constants in here. Just better or worse. So what we want to do, so this is now starting to do the math of the portfolio comparison. The fundamental thing that we have to define is a preference relation. So I use this curvy greater than or equal to. So V and W are two portfolio vectors, and we'll write V is better than W, means that we prefer V to W. Now, in the classic mean variance optimization, it's clear what the definition of that relationship is. Better means that it has a higher expected return. So we know there's a vector rho, which is it's a vector, and we know that among all the possible values that the expected return R might have, in fact, it's equal to that particular value. So better just means that it has a higher portfolio expected return. That's what it means. It's a scalar function. Now, and then the problem that we solve is it's a constrained optimization. We want to find the most preferable W within a certain set of constraints. And these would be, for example, I'll give you a bunch of examples, risk limit. So for example, it could have to be inside an ellipsoid that says the total risk is less than some quantity. You could, for example, have this risk ellipsoid together with the constraint that you'd be market neutral, so the sum of all the weights add to zero, or some weighted sum add to zero. Or you could have a total investment constraint, so you could say the sum of the absolute values of my investment have to be less than a fixed number. You could put position limits, so you could say that each component can only be, can put at most, $10,000 in each stock, or each one can be at most, 10% of the total float. Or there might be fancier things. You might say the portfolio that I'm going to put on next week can incur at most 50 basis points of transaction cost slippage relative to my current position. So you estimate the transaction costs you're going to incur in getting to the new portfolio, and you say, I'm going to put a risk limit, and then in addition, it has to be close to my current portfolio. So whatever you want can go into there. And then what I want to emphasize is the final portfolio is a compromise between two things, just as in material science. I mean, as we were talking about Gene Taylor, the materials things, you look at what it's trying to do, what are the obstacles to get there. Here, what you're trying to do is have a desirable portfolio, and that interacts with the constraints. So you want the most desirable portfolio that satisfies the constraints. Now, in the mean variance, classic Markowitz case, this is a straightforward math problem. It means maximizing a scalar function, f of w, which is the expected return. So there's a function. You give me a candidate vector w, I evaluate the expected return, and I just look for the point within my constraints that maximizes that. The problem is, what do we do if there is no vector rho, which means there is no function, there's nothing to evaluate, and there's nothing to maximize? That's the question. So we can't maximize a function because there's no numbers there to maximize. All right, so here's the fundamental principle. We go in two steps. The first, and these are reasonable economic assumptions. What we do, the first principle, is that we take the information as given. So this is a set of constraints on the possible expected return vector. And our interpretation will say that portfolio V is better than portfolio W if it gives a higher final return, final expected return, in every possible realized value of the expected return vector, which is consistent with the information which we said we believe at the beginning. This turns out to be, in math language, a partial ordering, which means that there are many pairs of portfolios, V and W, which cannot be compared. It's simply not true that either one dominates the other. The reason is that there might be pairs of portfolios for which some possible expected return vectors are better for V and some are better for W. And in that case, this principle A does not permit us to compare them. The refinement of the preference is, point B here, is that V is better than W if V is better in a larger fraction of the cases that satisfy our given information. This is enough to give us a full ordering and in most cases of interest determine a unique best portfolio, and if not, a very small family. So that's basically the conceptual outline. So to set the stage, let me give you sort of two slides of complicated mathematics, just saying again what classic mean variance optimization is. In the classic case, there exists a vector rho. Let me define, I'm going to call it Q bar, which is a cone shape, which is the ray consisting of all multiples of all return vectors which are a positive multiple of the given vector. Then the statement is V is better than W if the inner product of V with W is better than W, sorry, V with rho is better than W against rho for all R in that ray. And the important point that I said there is that the magnitude of the expected return vector doesn't matter. And that's important here because I'm not doing the quadratic utility function. I'm talking about maximizing return within a constraint set. So if all the returns are 10% and 20% instead of 1% and 2%, it doesn't change the optimal portfolio. All that matters is the direction of the vector and how that interacts with the risk limit. And basically, what this says is I want to maximize the exposure to the good direction, which is rho, it's the direction of the expected return, and I want to point something out, which is going to be a subtle mathematical point, is that in this statement, my surfaces of constant goodness are planes, and I don't care where I am in the direction that goes orthogonal to the expected return vector. So I have some information, which is a vector, and I don't care where I am in the planes orthogonal to it. So I'm dividing the space of portfolios into relevant directions, which are aligned with the expected return, and irrelevant directions, which are tangential. And some more, here's $20 worth of notation for a trivial problem, but it's going to be exactly the same words and symbols in the general case. So let me just say what they all mean in this case. To formulate this in the way that I want to extend it, let me define, I'm calling it Q here, which is the half space of expected return vectors which have positive inner product with the given vector. And then that lets me divide the space Rn into what I call irrelevant directions, which is the boundary of that half space, and its orthogonal complement, which is it's actually the line, it's not the ray, it's the line which is orthogonal to that plane. So that is, as I said, it's the line containing the given vector. So that's the orthogonal complement to that space. And what I mean by irrelevant is that I have no sign belief. So I've done a subtle switch on you here. I started out saying that the information about this vector was equivalent to a ray in space. What I've actually done here, I want to focus now, well, I say it's the same information content to talk about the half space that has positive inner product. This is a little bit mysterious because you won't see why I'm doing it, so let me give you the actual case. Oh, no, let me say one more thing about this. So when I talk about portfolio preference, again, it's trivial in this case, but let me just put the words down so I can repeat them. What I want to do, emphasize, I want to measure my portfolio against the directions that have something to do with the information I have and ignore directions that don't have anything to do. So this giving that vector of information gives me a decomposition of the subspace into what I've called relevant and irrelevant. And there's two different ways to say this. It's not true, by the way, that V is better than W if V times R is better than W times R for all R in the half space. I have to either restrict the I have to restrict one or the other of these has to live in the appropriate subspace. So either I have to take only the relevant component of the portfolios and then apply that condition for all R in the subspace, in the half space, or I have to take it for all R only in the ray. And as I say, this is a little bit opaque because it's way overkill for this problem, but these exact words are all the same for the general case of inequality beliefs. So let me just give you sort of this little interlude. Let me give you some examples. Well, the way I would say this in general, we don't actually need the notation, but in general, there would be M inequality statements which have the format that there's these vectors, B1 to Dn, and the statement is that the inner product of these vectors, each of these vectors has positive inner product with the expected return. And it takes some tricky mathematics, but the construction I'm showing you applies for any number of constraints. There can be fewer constraints than assets, equal or more constraints than assets, which turns out to be important for some of the applications. So the statement is that there's this D, so D is a matrix. DR has to be non-negative, and that's an M component condition. D is a matrix of size N by M. For example, for what we call the simple sort, which is this R1, that they don't list it into order, the number of constraints is n minus 1, and this D matrix has rows which are just 1 minus 1. So each one of those rows expresses a belief about that R1 is greater than R2, R2 is greater than R3. And if you want to generalize it, just give you an example of, I have more examples later, but you might, for example, have sectors, and you might have ordering within each sector, but no information about the relative magnitude of the sector. That fits right into the same format. DR is greater than or equal to 0, but D is a smaller matrix of size n minus k by n. All right, so now let me give you the construction in the general case. I define the consistent cone. So this is a cone in the sense that if something's in it, every positive multiple of it is in it. This is a set of possible of return vectors which satisfy the inequality constraints we've written down. So DR is greater than or equal to 0. This is the set of expected return vectors that could be the true expected return vector given the beliefs that we've said we have. They're expected returns that are consistent with our beliefs. Fundamental hypothesis is that that's all the information we have. You give me the matrix D, there's nothing else you're allowed to say. You say, I think D is in this cone. You give me the cone. And in a more general formulation, you can just give me the cone. You don't have to give me the matrix. It could even be, say, a cone with curved sides, if you think it's a circular cone. This is always going to be a cone with planar sides. But it could be a curved cone. We can't think of any examples where it would have curved sides, but mathematics permits it. One technical comment is, the one thing that's required in the mathematics is that cone has to have a non-empty interior, which unfortunately means you cannot sneak in equality constraints by putting in a vector and it's negative. You might think that you could, right? I mean, within the framework I've told, because all these are greater than or equal to, you could say, I think that, you know, R1 plus R2 equals 0, and you're going to fake that by saying it's greater than or equal to 0 and less than or equal to 0. That kills our theory because this thing has to have non-empty interior. So, same language as before. The consistent cone Q is the set of possible return vectors. That has, so in general, that has some directions. So the irrelevant directions, R perpendicular, is the set of return vectors for which that matrix is zero. The significance of that is that if a vector R in this irrelevant direction, either that vector or its negative is a possible return vector from the information you've given me. For example, if you tell me, just imagine R3, you tell me R1 is bigger than or equal to R2, R2 is bigger than or equal to R3, they could all be positive or they could all be negative. Both of those are equally possible. So this is the subspace of directions where either the vector or its negative is possible. The orthogonal subspace to that is what we call R. That happens to be, linear algebra fact, the span of the belief vectors, if there are belief vectors. It's the span of the belief vectors. And then what we call the relevant cone is the consistent cone intersected with the relevant directions. Just if I wave my hand in three dimensions, suppose there's three assets, two beliefs, R1 is bigger than R2, R2 is bigger than R3. That's two half spaces, so the consistent cone is a wedge shape. It's a wedge. And R perpendicular is the spine of that wedge. That core, when you move along that spine, you add a constant to all the things. You add one to all the returns, they still satisfy the conditions. So that it's R perpendicular is the spine of that, and R is the plane, which is orthogonal to that spine, and then Q bar is the intersection of this wedge with that plane, so it's a wedge, it's a planar wedge. That's the geometry in R3. Turns out one of the problems with this is R2 and R3 are very unrepresentative. So you have to sort of believe the math. Same preference definition is that what you do is, so this again induces an orthogonal decomposition. V is better than W if these are equivalent, if the relevant part of the portfolios delivers a higher return for all possible returns, or equivalently, if the entire portfolio delivers a higher return only for returns which are not all possible returns but are in this consistent cone. And what I'm doing, so what we're saying is you want to ignore directions in portfolio space for which our beliefs do not give us any sign information. I'm sorry this is so complicated. Really, you know, if this is complicated, but let me just say that what we're saying is that this portfolio is better than that one if it gives higher return for all possible return vectors. Unfortunately, that's not possible because, for example, in the case of a sort, you don't know whether the average is positive or the average is negative. So that would force, that definition would force all your portfolios to be completely market neutral. Because if you had a positive exposure to the market, then you would get you'd get a better positive return if the market goes up, a negative return if it goes down. We want to filter out that direction. And then there's a strict preference condition, which is that V is better than or equal to W, but not conversely. And it says there's one return which achieves extremality. Here's a picture in R2. So R2, with the simple sort case, so the belief is that R1 is bigger than R2. That set is the lower right half plane. So R1 bigger than or equal to R2 is the lower right half plane. The set of portfolios, this is portfolio space, W1, W2, you take a candidate initial portfolios, all the portfolios in this shaded region, this shaded half space, are strictly better than W for the reason that they have greater exposure, E1 is a, forget it, that's a dual vector, but they have greater exposure to the difference vector, the thing that we've said is positive. And you can formulate this, I didn't write it here, but maybe I should have. You can think of the rows D as being components of the return. As long as you have positive exposure to each of those components, you're going to get positive return. Now, carrying on the portfolio construction, what we want to do is we want to look for extremal portfolios, that is ones that are, well, basically the definition will be, I think it's on the next slide, we want to look for maximally preferable portfolios over the allowable set, which I'll call script M. It's the set of portfolios that satisfy constraints. Examples, just to repeat, you could have a risk limit, so it's an ellipsoid. You could have the market neutral risk ellipsoid, which is the ellipsoid intersected with the plane. It's a planar ellipsoid. Or something like this polyhedral shape. And I put this up because this is an interesting shape because it has flat facets and edges and corners. So you're not allowed, in the mathematics, you're not allowed to assume that the thing has a unique normal or that the normal varies smoothly. You have to be a little careful in the math, just like crystal growth. All right, how do we define extremal portfolios? So definition, W, so an allowable weight vector W is extremal if there is no allowable portfolio which strictly dominates it. So U means W would be a candidate investment. There's nothing that's strictly better than it. Obviously, if there is one that strictly dominates it, you would never want to do W. Main result, the math, turns out to be surprisingly tricky, is that if and only if condition to be an extremal portfolio is that there exists a normal vector to the constraint set M, which is in that set. M may have, at a boundary point, M may have a single normal vector, or it may have a family of normal vectors. This Q bar is a cone, a lower dimensional cone in the space of possible returns, and it says that there must exist a normal which is in that family, that these sets must intersect. More precisely, here's the precise statement, because there's some conditions. Suppose that M has a supporting hyperplane at W, and the normal to that supporting hyperplane is in this projected consistent cone. Then, if either B is a strict normal, or if B is in the interior of that cone, then W is an extremal point. There are counterexamples if one of those is not strict. Converse statement, suppose that Q has a non-empty interior, suppose that M is convex, if W is an extremal point, then there is a supporting hyperplane to M at W whose normal B is in that cone. So that's the if and only if, more or less. Proof, generally speaking, it's actually a couple of pages of... I was surprised how tricky it turned out to be, but it's about 2 pages of sort of convex analysis and limits, and you really need the interior condition, but basically relies on the separating hyperplane theorem, at least for one of them. The other one doesn't. The second one does. The first one doesn't. But it's nice. You know, that's one of our favorite theorems in finance, so it's nice to see it coming up. Examples. Let me give you some examples. The example of what I'll do is I'll consider the case of a single sort. Remember I said that the optimal portfolio is an interaction between the belief set and the constraint set. One of the later sections, I will show you a wide variety of belief sets. For now, I'm going to take a single belief set, which is the full ordering, and I'm going to consider a selection of constraint sets. First example is total investment constraint. So in 2 dimensions, that says that you have to be in this diamond shape. In 3 dimensions, it would be a octahedron. So it's not too hard to see, actually you don't need the math, that any extremal portfolio has to be of this form. No investment in the middle things, entirely long the first, short the last, we're adding up the W, and that means that the extremal set is this line segment. Any point along that line is extremal. Just go long the top, short the bottom, arbitrary amount. And the multi-sector case is long short within each sector. There's no covariance matrix. There's no room for covariance. There's no risk here. That's not too surprising. In the case of the risk ellipsoid, so W transpose V is less than or equal to sigma squared, the geometry is fairly simple. At any boundary point W, there's a unique normal, which is the vector B is V times W, and a condition for B... E is not really necessary, but let me say that the columns of the matrix E are essentially the dual vectors to the belief set. There's a specific representation of the extremal vectors. You take a vector with positive components in Rm and take the specific linear combination. So, for example, this is a set of dimension n minus 2 on the surface of dimension n minus 1. So, for example, in the case of 2 assets, what you do is you look at the single point on the boundary where the normal is the vector 1 minus 1. That's the extremal point. That's the vector, that's the portfolio that gives you the maximal exposure to the difference, which you've said is positive. You said that's positive. This one happens to be slightly short the market. W1 plus W2 is negative, but we're not looking at that. Slightly more complicated. Again, this is a case where you need the correct statement of the theorem. So if it's market neutral, that means you take the risk ellipsoid. In addition, you add the condition that you're on this plane, which is neutral to the market. Then M is a subspace of codimension 1. Its boundary is dimension n minus 2. At any particular point, there's a 1-parameter family of normals because it's a planar set. So there's a 1-parameter family of normals. That set has to intersect the cone Q bar. It turns out that you do the projections and so on, and you can again characterize what the points are. It turns out in dimension n with a single sort, m is n minus 1, it's an n minus 2-dimensional patch on the surface of this ellipsoid. And in the case n equals 2, well, there's nothing to optimize because you're intersecting this market neutral line, W1 plus W2 equals 0, with the ellipsoid, and you just pick that point. In n equals 3, it's a little more complicated. Sorry, not a great picture. It's the best that MATLAB can do. In n equals 3, So the axes here, W1, W2, W3, you're constrained to be on that ellipsoid. The red arc is the arc of extremal portfolios without the market neutrality condition. The blue arc is the arc of extremal portfolios with the market neutrality condition. It's a particular segment of that ellipsoid. And those are the points on that ellipsoid that satisfy the condition that I wrote down. Now the question, which is the second part, is in some sense I've done a lot, so I've restricted the set of allowable portfolios that you should consider from the entire set to a set of a somewhat smaller set, but I haven't told you how to choose a single point. That's what we need to do. We need to come up with a single point. How are we going to choose a single point on that set? Well, there's one obvious idea, which is thinking about the risk ellipsoid example. I told you that there was this vector x which had to have positive components, and that was a parameterization of the extremal set. One obvious thing you can do is take, in some sense, the central point of that set by, since you're allowed to take any positive vector, the obvious neutral one to take is the one who has all the same components, 1, 1, 1, 1. If you plug that in, it turns out that's equivalent to assuming linear imputed returns. So you're basically saying, I think the first stock is going to go up by X, the last stock is going to go down by X, and then in between there'll just be linear imputed returns. Not the portfolio vectors are linear, but the returns are linear. You take that return vector, you plug it into mean variance optimization, and you get your portfolio. The question is, that's a pretty ad hoc statement. Can we do better? Fortunately, the answer is yes. So can we come up with some reasoning that gives you a more logical thing to do? Here's the second idea, optimal portfolios. So optimal, so a single optimal portfolio. Suppose V and W are two portfolios. Both of them are extremal. They're both on the extremal set. That means that neither one dominates the other. It means that for each, there are some return vectors consistent with our information for which V gives a higher return. There are some vectors for which W gives a higher return. The idea is to refine the definition to say V is better than W if V is more often better. So if the set of possible expected returns has for which V is better is larger than the set of possible returns for which W is better. That opens a can of worms because we need to define what more often means. So in order to make that make sense, what we need to do is to introduce a measure. So we need to introduce some measure on this cone of possible returns. And then the statement will be that V is better than W if the measure of the set of possible returns for which V gives a better return. And actually, I forgot, I should have projected out the irrelevant directions, but this is logically the correct thing. If that set has larger measure than the set for which W gives better returns than V, okay? And so that includes the previous definition if one of these measures is zero, the other one is one. But it's a refinement. Obviously, the previous one just said, well, if one measure is zero and the other one is one, then it's clear which is better. Now we're saying we'll consider ratios between, or relative values between zero and one. The question is what measure to use. It has to be some measure, obviously. Let me remind you that this cone is an infinite set, so it should have finite total measure for this to work at all. Our idea, and I have to justify this to you. You should criticize it, but let me justify it. Let me anticipate your criticism. Let me remind you that the only information we've given is that the expected return lies in some cone, Q, the consistent cone consistent with our information. I'll say it again, keep beating on this point, there's no other information. Therefore, our hypothesis is that the natural distribution to assume is something which is radially symmetric within this cone. So, for example, the measure could be a Gaussian measure, e to the minus r squared over some radius rho, times the indicator function of the cone. It's not radially symmetric everywhere. It's radially symmetric within the cone. What we're essentially saying is that any point within that cone has equal probability as any other point within the cone, subject to the fact that the density has to decrease as you go away because it has to have finite total measure. So more precisely, that any point has the same probability is happening as any other point that's the same Euclidean distance away from the origin. Now, this is a somewhat dramatic assumption because it's not at all obvious that you, essentially a different way to say this, radial symmetry, I'm saying that the operation of Euclidean rotation is the natural symmetry on this space. So when you do a Euclidean rotation from point V to point, from one return to another, that's the natural thing to stay equal. Now, the moment I say it that way, I hope that what will pop into your mind is the idea that that's insane, that obviously the correct measure, we should renormalize things doing something with the covariance matrix. You say, surely the covariance matrix should be in there somehow. Maybe we should scale, maybe we should go to some affine change of coordinates so that the covariance matrix becomes diagonal, becomes the identity even. And then in that scaled coordinates, in that space it should be. It should be, radial symmetry. Or maybe when I compare, return vector R1 to R2, what I should not be saying is they're the same if the Euclidean distance is the same, but maybe they should be the same if the R transpose V times R is the same. Maybe the covariance matrix should be in there. So I remind you that we're assuming, that the covariance matrix information is completely other than your beliefs about expected return. So all we're doing, we're really taking at face value the inequality statements that we assume you made, I made, but let's assume you made them, about the return vectors, and that there's no other information. And I also another observation is that I claim that the original coordinates are the natural scaling, if only because all the returns have the same units. If return one was measured in feet and return two was measured in hours, then it wouldn't make any sense to talk about radial symmetry. This wouldn't make any sense. But they're not. They're all measured in the same units, percent per year or whatever. So there's a natural, this is the natural scaling. Measure them all in the same units. And then it's radial symmetry. Then the rest is just geometry. The rest is just geometry, just like back in high school or calculus, all those exercises in multivariable calculus. What you have to do to translate this into a concrete prescription is, well, let me remind you. So we have this preference relation. The way we characterize it is by identifying the level set. So given a particular portfolio W, what is the set of V's which are equally preferable? Those are the set of V's for which the measure given W, so you look at the V's, it's the measure of the set R for which that V is again, sorry, it's backwards. Greater than, less than, it's okay. So these two sets have to have the same measure. What that means is that the plane whose normal is V minus W has to bisect the set Q, bisect it with this density mu, which means that it has to pass through the centroid vector of that cone. So this identifying this level set comes down to computing the centroid vector of the cone C. So that's this geometrical condition. So what it says is that there's a special, centroid is the center of mass. So that's the thing in high school, you draw a shape on cardboard, you cut it out, you put the, you balance it on the edge of the ruler until it balances, you draw a line, you draw another line, balance it, you don't draw the line. All those lines pass through the same point. That's the remarkable fact. And they all pass through the same point. That point is the centroid, it's the center of mass. So once you've figured out what the centroid, it's a geometrical calculation, once you've figured out what that is, this preference relation is simply equivalent to measuring, it's equivalent to measuring expected return, but the expected return vector is the centroid C. And then, so it's an effective return, and then by, let me just, what that selects is an extremal vector by previous definition. Once you've done that, you can do all the same calculations as before with constraints, position limits, transaction costs, whatever, same calculation. For example, in the simplest case with the risk limit, you get the prescription that the weight vector of your portfolio is simply V inverse times the centroid. That's what it is. So the imputed return is the centroid. Do some examples. How do you compute the centroid? It's an interesting challenge, by the way. There's a lot of interesting cases where you know how to compute it. Some interesting cases we don't know how to compute it. The simplest thing is Monte Carlo. So there's a simple observation that if you basically you take Gaussian samples, sort them into order, that's equivalent into introducing reflections that reflect you into the set Q, and then just take the mean of your samples. If you think about that a little bit, that's equivalent to order statistics. There's a huge statistical literature on that. In particular, this guy Blom wrote a PhD thesis in 1958, and it was a book. So there's this approximation, which the jth component of the centroid in n dimensions is the inverse cumulative normal function of a linear interpolation. See, so we work this out in detail, and we give you a numerical approximation for this coefficient alpha. And that gives you a very good approximation to the centroid. And so this is equivalent to normal scores. This is like normal scores. But it answers one of the questions which you might not have thought about. If I say, take the vector to be the inverse cumulative normal, the question is, where precisely do you put the endpoints? They can't be at 0 and n because the function is singular. You have to sort of offset them a little bit. This alpha is how much you offset the ends, how much they come in. And it turns out that to get it, you know, you have to sort of adjust the value depending on n. What does it look like? Here's what it looks like. This is the blue bars. The red bars are a linear portfolio. The blue bars are the centroid vector for a portfolio of size 10. So I drew the linear things, which are red. Maybe not the best presentation, but I drew the linear things in red so that you can see that the difference between the centroid and the linear is that it slightly overweights the ends. So you see the blue is above the red at the beginning, then actually the blue is below the red in the middle. So the centroid has a shape like that. And then again, the blue goes slightly more negative down here. What that says is that the first asset here, there's a ton of information attached to that because you've said it's better than 9 other assets. That's a lot of information. Whereas that this guy in the middle is really, you know, I don't know. It's sort of hand-wavy. I guess it's the same because you said it's worse than 4 of them and better than 5 of them, which is the same. But it basically naturally enhances the differences at the ends. That is the centroid vector. Let me say something here. If we did all of this just to handle a single sort case, it wouldn't have been worth it, because you could have figured that out probably by just sort of blundering your way through. The real value of this approach is that there are many other important cases which fit into the same framework, and our conceptual framework and more or less our algorithm carry over directly. So for this half a dozen interesting other cases, and we think of more all the time, we can tell you precisely how to form the best portfolio. Example, sector sorts. So I put that up before. You may have your investment universe divided into sectors, you know, different industries or something. And within each sector, you have an ordering, but you have no information about the relative returns between the sectors. But, you have covariance information about all the assets within the sectors, in between different sectors, about all of them. So you don't want to throw out that information, so you don't just want to form a portfolio. You also want an answer to say, how much should I put relatively in sector 1 to sector 2, given that I don't have the information? There's a sector, actually, I think it's on the next page. Let me just show you. Here's an example. This is the centroid vector for the example here as a first sector of size 10, second sector of size 50. You have inequality information, which says that this sector is sorted into order, that sector is sorted into order. The relative ratio between these things emerges naturally. That is the centroid of the wedge in the 60-dimensional space with a radially symmetric distribution. Go back to the second thing here, which is sort of the converse of that. You might have, for example, deciles. You might think that the stocks in decile 1 are better than the stocks in decile 2, or better than the stocks in decile 3, but no information within each decile, but you have covariance information about all of them. It's natural, we can tell you exactly what the centroid is for that set of beliefs. A couple other examples. You might have a complete sort, 1 to n, but in addition, you might believe that the first bunch of them are going to have positive return, the second bunch are going to have negative return, so there's a 0 in the middle. Centroid for that wedge looks like this. It's not quite the same is not the same as the centroid for 20 assets. It's a different centroid. It's actually closely equivalent to two half centroids. Other examples, you might have an index. So let's say you have, might be the S&P 500. So you have 500 assets. There's an index defined. You might believe that one chunk of stocks is going to overperform the index, so it'll have higher return. Another chunk of stocks is going to underperform the index. You have no idea by how much. This turns out to be, I guess it's just N constraints, so that works fine. So our algorithm would tell you, actually we don't know how to compute the centroid in that case, but if we did, it would tell you what portfolio to invest. You might also have information which is, we call higher order sorts. So you might say, you know what, my information is more reliable at the beginning. I think that the differences are bigger at the beginning, let's say. So not only do I have a complete sort, but in addition, I think that the difference between 1 and 2 is bigger than the difference between 2 and 3. So you say it's sort of not only is it, you know, linear, but maybe it's sort of curved up even more. I say, fine, another inequality. The more you got, put them in. We compute the centroid. There you go. Finally, and I just have this and then a few empirical slides, and then that's it, basically. What really comes up in practice, you might have, let's say you have multiple indicators. So you're doing book to market and size. You sort the stocks on one indicator and then some other one, which is who knows what. I mean, what the CEO had for breakfast or something, some indicator. You have multiple indicators. This is common. How should you combine multiple indicators? They're incompatible. You cannot really believe both of them. But you have these sorts. For example, reversals and book to market. So I have to say slightly more than I did, but I just won't say it. We can tell you how to form a combined centroid. Basically, the prescription is, instead of averaging together the indices, the numbers, the indexes, average together the centroid components. That gives you a specific combined centroid. You might have partial sorts. So you might have a sort on some of the assets, no information about the other assets. Or in this multiple incompatible, one of them might sort only the first two-thirds, the other one might sort only the last two-thirds, and they're incompatible where they overlap, and you have to deal with it somehow. You might have missing information, so you might not believe, say, the middle third, or we can tell you how to do that, too. Finally, brief empirical thing. So you shouldn't believe any of this so far, right? I mean, I've sort of spun this story that this is a logical way to do it. You can agree with me that this is logical, that it's beautiful, I hope, but the proof is you have to do some empirical tests and see how it works. So we did an extensive empirical test. I'll tell you what we did. We took 100 large cap stocks. Actually, we have much more in the paper. This is an old version. Take a bunch of large cap stocks, look at actually 12 years daily data. We implement the reversal strategy. So you look at the previous week's return, and you sort them. Each week, you sort them by their previous week's return, and then you form the portfolio. And we form, I think, actually only... I think this is actually, this is incorrect. We form a linear weighting. We form a risk-adjusted linear, which is one of the obvious things you might have. So at each step, we take that sort, we can just take the linear weighting by the weights, or we can take linear imputed returns, or we can take our algorithm, which is performance equal to the centroid. Here's the results. The bottom group, this is cumulative return over a couple of years, 3 years, cumulative return, the bottom group is the ones that don't use the covariance matrix. Very bad, okay? Very bad to not use the covariance matrix. The top, so I want to focus on the top two, which do use the covariance matrix. The blue is the one that you might thought of. That's the one with linear imputed returns. That gives, obviously, much better return than not using the covariance. But the red is our proposed thing, where the imputed returns are the centroid. That's something you probably would not have thought of without doing this analysis. And it's noticeably better than the blue. That's a significant difference. The other test we did, you don't want to see all that stuff. Sharpe ratios are great. Take my word for it. The other thing we did, I'll just say briefly in words what it is you might criticize. You see, this is a beautiful theory, but what if the data is somewhat wrong? What if they're sort of out of order, which they are in practice? There's always going to be errors. So what we did was do a big Monte Carlo simulation where we introduced permutations, pair reversals, to degrade the information. And actually, it involves copulas. I taught you guys about copulas. And so it's based on Gaussian copulas, this permutation algorithm. and then you normalize them, and you get, all I want to show you here is that it degrades, the performance degrades only very slowly. So you can commute these things a lot. So you know, we know what the distribution is because we imposed it, but you permute them and it really, you know, you can really, you look at the graph and they look like they're all mixed up and the returns are still strongly positive. And then I'm basically done. So two other comments. One is we have a patent pending, a U.S. patent pending on not the algorithm, but the business process associated with this. And we're licensing it to a software company. So they will sell software that uses this algorithm. And then if you want to read the preprint, I mean, it's on my webpage, but I kind of like if you would download it from SSRN because they count number of downloads. So everybody goes and downloads, we look better. So it's Social Science Research Network, www.papers.ssrn.com. And then final conclusion, okay, good math and finance, no problem there. We think it's a novel way to construct optimal portfolios. The empirical tests come out very positive, and this is not only really interesting mathematics, it turns out, really convex analysis and polar sets and so on, but it's extremely practical, and I mean, Neil, they're implementing it at SAC and testing it every different way, and it works very well. And actually, we considered keeping it secret and just implementing it, but that doesn't really work because, I don't know, people catch up with you. No, but it really is easy to apply and gives very good results. So, that's it.